يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. A warm welcome back to today's Middle East Analysis. Now, we've gone into the specifics and had an update on the situation in Syria, specifically the resignation of Ambassador Nawaf Faris, the Syrian ambassador to Iraq. Now, this is somewhat more of a regional roundup, but there are some key issues we need to look at, focused mainly around Egypt, around Libya, and around Palestine-Israel and that relationship and what's going on in that very crucial area. Joined again by Dr. Harry Hagopian, the Bishop's consultant on the Middle East North Africa region. And Harry, can we start with Libya? Mm-hmm. There may not be a huge amount to say, but it's certainly significant that we've had, in inverted commas, free elections. People seem to be reasonably positive that this is a clean slate and something positive for the future. Mahmoud Jibril,
mm-hmm.
Tell me about him, former chief of the National Transitional Council and former interim prime minister. Is that a positive thing for the country and its people, including Christians?
I think it's a very positive development for the country. I mean, a lot of people have been following what happened in Libya, because the Libyan revolution and the ouster of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi was not actually done solely by Libyans. It was pretty much done by NATO air power that eventually managed to get rid of Gaddafi and his cohorts. So in a sense, given the tribal makeup of Libya, given that you've got militias all across the country, the question was, and still remains to some extent, whether the country would be cohesive, whether it would come together, whether it would be able to become a real state, or whether it would remain a fragmented collection of entities. And one of the key developments in Libya is that at the moment we've just had elections for the General National Congress, or what we would call parliament. And what has happened is that the initial results, the full results aren't out yet, but the initial results show that Mahmoud Jibril and his alliance have actually got a sweeping majority in those elections. Now, what does that mean? Mahmoud Jibril is somebody who's educated in the States, somebody who would be viewed as a liberal. And here he is and his alliance getting the majority of seats, or probably will get the majority of seats. Now, why is this important? This is important because when we look at the region, everybody was saying, look at Egypt, look at Tunisia. The trend has been for a wave of Islamism or Islamist parties to take over. I mean, in Egypt, we have certainly got the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafist Nur party. In Tunisia, we also have Islamist parties who are doing well within parliament and within the political establishment of the country. So people were saying, is this going to be a wave of Islamists across the whole region? My argument first had been, and still remains, that it's not such a bad thing if the majority of the people vote in fair and free elections for Muslim deputies in parliament, for Muslim presidents, for Muslim representatives, then that is their choice and we should respect that choice.
But obviously you'd hope that they'll be making noises about being fair, open and just to minorities such as the Christians in these countries.
Of course they would. And what is happening is that in some of those countries, the Muslim parties are making an impact. But in Libya, the trend has changed. Now it is the Liberal Party which is making headway. They're the ones headed by Mahmoud Jibril who are thinking of a national unity government which brings all those parties together. So basically what I'm saying is that it's so diverse, it is so unpredictable, things are so new in the Middle East and North Africa with all those uprisings that we cannot really sit down and say with any absolute degree of certainty as to where we're going. We're going to be surprised as much as the people in that region are going to be surprised. But there is another interesting point there. Many people are fear-mongering, that the Christian communities are going to be swamped under a wave of Islamism, that all their rights are going to be taken away from them because Islam is coming to take over, and that Sharia law would apply in all its strictness. Well, look at Libya. It's bucked the trend. It's not the same result that we got in Egypt. So there is a diversity. There is hope for the future. And with the constitution to be drafted in Libya, with a new government to be put in place, I think that we are seeing very interesting days across the whole Middle East and North Africa. So for those people of doom and gloom, it is not all doom and gloom. It is all a process of change.
You know, you've picked me up a bit there. I feel like saying cautious optimism with regard to Libya.
Cautious optimism would work. And don't forget that Libya is a very rich country. It's a very small country with a very small population. So we're talking about 3 point something million people who are eligible voters. And therefore, in that sense, it's a country that's not very populated, but which has got a lot of oil. So if it is run properly and it's got the money to prop up a proper system of governance, then who knows? We might actually be going toward good moments.
You mentioned Egypt, and I'm going to ask you whether we're going to be going towards good moments there. There is a worry about it becoming an Islamic caliphate, in inverted commas, but we've gone there a few times as well. And as you said, really, with regard to Libya, let's not pursue that too far or get too worried about that. But President Morsi, now obviously there's been something of a clash with SCAF,
The military council.
Now, the military council, before those presidential elections, dissolved parliament, and didn't they make some constitutional changes in order to retain their power as an entity?
Yes, they did. I think the interesting thing about Egypt, James, is that there are three parties that are playing a big role. On the one hand, you've got the SCAF, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, or the Military Council, which wants to keep its influence. Let us not forget that roughly 30% of the economy is owned or run by the Military Council, so they have high stakes in what is happening in Egypt. So you have the Military Council on the one hand, you have the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafist parties, who for the first time ever in the Arab world have actually been voted in through fair and free elections, which is what all the international observers have said was the case in Egypt, who are now in power, who had a parliament which was pretty much Islamist in color, who have a new president who hails from the Muslim Brotherhood. So in a sense, those are the two competing parties, and it's a tug of war. One pulls in one direction, the other pulls in the other direction. Then you have the other liberal, leftist, Nasserist parties who are trying to regroup, who are trying to find a way of impacting the political future of Egypt. So we have the IAEA former chief al-Baradei, who has just set up his own constitution party, who's having a say in the future of the country. We have Hamdin Sabahi, who is a Nasserist, who did very well in the elections, who's basically talking about how reforms should take place, both of the judiciary and the assembly. But altogether, it is actually a moment where, although there is this tug of war between the military on the one hand and the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamist parties on the other, I think also that Egyptians are very realistic, pragmatic people. And at the end of the day, there's a lot of wheeling and dealing going on politically. And I believe that there is some sort of a modus vivendi that would be reached between all people for the good of the country.
Now, I don't want to break the record and rabbit on about this any further, but I do have to ask it. Is Morsi a positive change as president with regard to the Coptic Christian community, in your view and what you know on the street?
Let me put it this way. There are two things that are happening here. One, you mentioned the issue of the annulment of the parliament, and then President Morsi trying to reinstate it, and now he has agreed that the judiciary have the final word, so it's not going to be reconvened. We are seeing that clash, and in a sense, what has happened is the following. Look at Egypt in this way, James. You have a parliament that's pretty much in limbo. You have a strong presence of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamist parties. You have got an army that holds quite a lot of sway. You've got a restless public. You've got an economic crisis. And at the end of the day, I sincerely believe that economy will basically drive the political imperatives of Egypt as well as anywhere else. Put all those factors I just mentioned to you, and what do you get? You get seeds that remind us of previous history. It reminds us, for instance, perhaps of Iran in 1979. It perhaps reminds us of Algeria in 1991. It might remind us even of Pakistan in 1999. It might even take us back to the old model of Turkey before Erdogan and his party took control. Does it even remind us of Egypt in 1954? What do I mean by all this? If you take all those examples I've given you, these are examples where a country, Pakistan, Turkey, Algeria, Egypt, were fractured, and when the military came in to reclaim power in the name of stability. The fear, one fear in the country amongst leftists, amongst liberals, amongst people who want a democracy for Egypt's future, are worried that this is what's going to happen, that the clash is going to lead to the military taking over again. I would beg to differ. I think that we're past the stage where the military can do those coups as they did in the past. And I think in this larger picture, the Christian Copts, be they Orthodox in their large majority, but also Catholic Copts as well as Evangelical Copts, should always remember that they are part and parcel of Egypt, that they're citizens of Egypt, that their rights and their responsibilities are the same as anybody else's in Egypt, and therefore what happens to everybody else in Egypt will happen to them, of course, with the very, very clear proviso that they are treated fairly and they are given their due rights. Will this happen? I hope so. Is it happening? Too early to tell.
Now, crikey, that melting pot of aspirations, of desires, the driver of the economy, it's certainly a watch this space for Egypt, isn't it?
Exactly so. Another few question marks for Egypt, just as you raised with Syria earlier.
Well, what about that part of the Middle East that was often the center point of all media concerns, Palestine, Israel? I don't really know where to start, Harry, but I think a place to start might be an article that you yourself wrote a few days ago on a former PLO leader, Yasser Arafat, who died in 2004, a good 8 years ago now. Now, Al Jazeera is having a close look at his death and in fact, what might have interfered with that, a possible Alexander Litvinenko-style polonium poisoning that might have killed the old man. Tell us a little bit more about your article, your speculations, and forgive me for saying it, why is that important?
That, I think, is the key question or the crucial question. What I would say is, rather than bore our listeners with a rehash of my article, I'm sure you're going to post it on the website of the conference on our MENA page, and therefore many people would have access to it, and they would then go and read the cluster of questions I raise about the fact that there are allegations that Yasser Arafat was poisoned by polonium. But the two questions I will pick from what you said is, why are we following this route now? And more to the point, why now, 8 years after his death? Given the half-life of polonium as a radioactive element, and I'm not going to go into details now, if we wanted to make sure that he was poisoned from polonium, we should have exhumed the body 4, 5, 6 years ago, not now. So why are we doing it now? Are we doing it now because Palestine has been the hub of the Arab world and it no longer is because it's a little bit lost in the middle of this whole Arab Spring, so-called, and the Palestinian leadership, Al Jazeera, and many other people are trying to reawaken or arouse or revive interest in the Palestinian case, which I think is legitimate because at the end of the day, it remains the hub of the Arab world? Or is it that the Palestinian Authority is so bedeviled with an economic and financial meltdown, with talk of corruption, with listlessness, that they are trying to basically bring this up again in order to divert attention from other things that are happening in the country? Is it because of the tensions between Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah? There are lots and lots of questions, I think, that are there, which might perhaps explain or go some way toward explaining why Yasser Arafat has become a radioactive Palestinian.
Well, something that has made the news over here, and mainly as a result of the Church of England's General Synod sitting, is the endorsement, if you like, the approval of the work of the Ecumenical Accompaniment Group in Palestine and Israel, I think commonly known as EAPPI.
Indeed.
You can tell us a little bit about their work, whether or why it's controversial, or why, more to the point, the Church of England has taken this step of sort of formally supporting its work, because obviously it's met with some consternation from Israel, perhaps somewhat unsurprisingly. But tell us a little bit about that with General Synod in mind.
Yeah, James, very briefly, EAPPI, or the Ecumenical Accompaniment Persons in Israel and Palestine, is basically a movement that was originally created by the World Council of Churches in Geneva. The whole idea behind it is that they recruit believers, Christians from all the different churches. So we've got the Church of England, we've got the Catholic Church, the Methodist Church, the Lutheran Church, the Presbyterian Church, from all over the world, from the UK, Europe, United States, Asia. These people come together, they're trained, they're briefed, and then they're sent over for periods of 6 months to Israel and Palestine in order to observe what is happening there.
Yeah, I've seen them at checkpoints and stuff in Jerusalem.
They are at checkpoints. For instance, some of them come to checkpoints where they monitor whether the Israeli soldiers treat the Palestinians who are allowed to cross those checkpoints from one part of Palestine into another, whether they're treated with dignity, with respect or not. You can find them in hot spots like Nablus, like Hebron, which are important towns within Palestine. But you can also find them in Israel proper itself, where they go and live with the community. That's what they do. They live with people, they experience the reality there, they participate in the Christian witness of the Arab-Palestinian Christians, but they are also open to Muslims and Israelis. And then they come back and they report to their own churches, to the World Council of Churches, and to many other people. Now, what has happened is that the General Synod of the Church of England recently, this week, approved a motion that would endorse the work of the EAPPI. The Israeli sources in this country and elsewhere were very critical of that step taken by General Synod of the Church of England, because they consider EAPPI as being unfriendly toward Israel. What I would say are two simple things. These are well-meaning Christians, believers from across the whole world who go there to bear witness and to learn and stand in solidarity with a people under occupation. We should respect their ethos, we should respect their integrity, we should respect their work. But I would also say that there is an occupation. So if that occupation is a little bit bothersome because the consequences and the reporting of it is bothersome, then the best way of dealing with it is to remove the occupation.
I'm not going to take exception to any of that, but I am going to ask, because I think it's important to ask, can you see why the Israelis would feel more under scrutiny, number one? And number two, are the Palestinians under similar scrutiny by this group?
I think that one of the questions that bothers, I think, some of the people about this group is that they spend more time with Palestinians than they do with Israelis. That might well be true, but Israel is a democracy in as much as we understand a democracy in the Middle East. And it is an independent state. It does not need the kind of accompaniment that Palestinians need in the occupied territories. So therefore, it is understandable that the churches in Jerusalem, the churches of the Holy Land, the Anglicans, the Catholics, the Orthodox, the Lutherans, all the churches are very happy to welcome those people, to come and stand in solidarity with them. Now, do they scrutinize their work? Of course they do. I've heard them say many critical things, some of those monitors, about what happens in Israel as much as what happens in the Palestinian territories. They are a prism through which we can see what is happening in that part of the world. And I think their role is important. Their integrity is to a large degree unquestionable. And whether they ruffle some political feathers or not, the more feathers they ruffle, in my opinion, the more of a good job they are doing. Now, clearly, we are living in a political world where this doesn't doesn't go down well with many, many people. I respect those opinions that would disagree with mine, but I think that this is a program that has been running for years and years in this country, managed largely by the Quakers, but with all the other churches supporting it. So therefore, I would say, let us not be too critical of those people, young and old, who go there and who take with them their own understanding of the situation and perhaps come back with a different one.
Well, one thing is for sure, you need a bit of bravery sometimes. You need the truth to be pushed out there. So,
you know what I call it, James? Prophetic courage, which is central to our Christian faith and theology.
Nicely said, Harry. That is Dr. Harry Hagopian, a former Assistant General Secretary of the Middle East Council of Churches, and on top of that, a very good lawyer and a political commentator as well. Thank you very much for listening to Middle East Analysis. You can catch us on catholicnews.org.uk and then either put in the search Middle East Analysis or Harry Hagopian, or if you want the direct link, it's catholicnews.org.uk/middle-east-analysis. Catch us on iTunes. Again, you can search for Harry Hagopian. It'll come up very prominently on there. And also epectarsis.net. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian's website. And you can catch him on Twitter as well, as I said earlier.
And might I add finally, James, that we should also thank one of our colleagues who's helping us broaden the appeal and the access of those podcasts to a wider audience. Because the more people that listen to it, more people would interact with it, the more feedback we get, and that would also help us in the future with what we are trying to do.
That's a grudging thanks very much to Mr. Steve Gammons. Well, thank you very much for listening, and we'll be with you very soon on Middle East Analysis.